Hi, my name is Mike Mays. My birth date is October 15th, 1963.
Okay, Mike, welcome to the Project Life during the pandemic in Kentucky. As we discussed, this is a project to accumulate an archive at the University of Louisville, and the project is being done in conjunction with the University of Louisville Oral History Program, as well as the Oral History Commission. Well, again, thank you for participating.
You're welcome.
I'm going to start out with asking you, can you tell me who you were and what you were doing prior to your knowledge of the gravity of the COVID virus?
Wow, who I was. I'll try to make this a short answer. I am the co-owner and co-founder and president of a small group of coffee shops based here in Louisville, Kentucky, called Heine Brothers Coffee. We've been operating coffee shops in Louisville for a little over 26 years now. We were founded in October, or we opened our first shop October 1st of 1994. Today we have 18 coffee shops. Pre-COVID, we had approximately moving up on 300 employees. Post-COVID, because of scaled back operations, we're at about 225 now. We're, again, operating shops all over the Louisville area, and we have a couple of shops in southern Indiana. We roast all of our coffee here in Louisville's Portland neighborhood. I'm also the father, I'm married and the father of four children, two of whom are in college right now, and two of whom are in high school.
All right. So the next question is, tell me how your life changed abruptly and up till now, once you figured out the gravity of the COVID pandemic.
Well, the biggest immediate change in the middle of March was for my wife and me. We were scheduled to go to a wedding celebration in Asheville, North Carolina. It was going to be like Friday, March the 13th, whatever that Friday was in the middle of March, we were supposed to leave. It was going to be just the two of us getting away. We had arranged to stay in the Grove Park Inn, a historic hotel there in Asheville. Some wonderful friends who had gotten married earlier the year before, but they were having a friends and family celebration in Asheville that we were just looking so forward to it. And around Wednesday of that week, we started hearing about, you know, things changing, people changing what they were doing, meetings being canceled, events being postponed. And on that Thursday of March 13th, 14th, somewhere around there, my wife and I were sitting at the kitchen table and we looked at each other and we said, I think we're going to have to cancel this trip. And so we notified our friends and notified the hotel and just said, we're not coming. And it was probably the next Monday, maybe around March the 16th or 17th. I don't have my calendar in front of me. I was sitting at work with some of my operations team, and we were having a meeting. And it was that Monday or Tuesday, and we got word that the governor of Ohio was forcing restaurants and bars to close to in-person dining. And we thought, "Oh my gosh, is this serious?" And within a matter of no time, that day or the next day, we had made the decision to close our stores to in-person service or dining. We did keep our drive-thrus open, but that from there, it just, you know, things, it seemed to get a little crazier. But those were the biggies. You know, I had to cancel a personal getaway, which, you know, never had to do anything like that in my life. And then the next week, it showed up in a big way in my business. And I can talk for a long time about how it showed up in my business, for sure.
Well, talk a little bit about that, please. You're the closest I've come to anybody that's actually in the food service industry.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about those. That first 2 to 3 weeks was very, very intense. You know, none of us knew. It was frightening for all of us. And particularly frightening for the people that were working on the front lines in the coffee shop for us. Now, even though we had closed the cafes to in-person dining, we'd scaled back operations dramatically. We weren't letting people sit in our coffee shops. most of the business was going through our driveway. Through our customer, our employees were still having to interact with customers, and there was no mask mandate yet. People weren't wearing, some people were wearing masks, but a lot were not. And so the anxiety level was very, very high. You know, from the business standpoint, it was like, oh my gosh, are we going to be able to do enough business here to survive, you know, pay the bank back, make our rent payments, make payroll. And, but equally important on the employee side, oh my gosh, are we doing, is this the right thing to do? Are we putting our employees at risk? Should we be doing more? You know, what would more look like? And as we were wrestling with those things, I can't remember the dates exactly, but within the first two to four weeks, and it was fairly quickly, we started hearing about, the CARES Act, was beginning to form it in Washington. But anyway, before the CARES Act was final and out, you know, we had employees, you know, beginning to say to us, hey, we deserve combat pay. You know, we're on the front lines here. You know, we're hearing about other places paying hazard pay. You know, where's our hazard pay? And, again, we were trying to be, we weren't very sure-footed because this was brand new territory.
Well, really?
And then almost out of nowhere, and this really caught me by surprise, I got an email from one particular employee where she shared a letter that approximately 20 of our, 250 plus employees had signed, demanding that we provide PPE, personal protective equipment, mm-hmm. mask, gloves, and back then everybody was thinking you needed the super special, just a cloth mask, the super mask, and, increased hazard pay, or they were going to stage a sick out.
Whoa. So,
yeah, again, we've prided ourselves on at that point we've been open 25 and a half years. We prided ourselves on really trying to be a healthy and positive place to work, where we really worked hard to try to treat people with respect and dignity, starting with our employees. And I did that very intentionally because I wanted to create a place where people liked where they worked. But the reality is, it is today, and it was then. We'd grown to be a pretty big company, with 250 plus employees, and I used to know everybody. And, even though I meet people during their first week of employment at an orientation day, I quickly lose touch. And I didn't, and anyway, I was really caught by surprise by that. And so I sat down and I crafted a long, what I considered very thoughtful response to this employee, that said, we are doing the best that we can. I understand the anxiety level and I get it completely. Even if we wanted to, nobody has access to PPE right now. I mean, that's when everybody was scrambling to try to get it. Hospitals didn't have enough of it. I said, said I would provide that for you, I couldn't have access to it. And I said, based on what we're learning from the CARES Act, we had already applied for a PPP loan, a Paycheck Protection Program loan. I said, our application is in. It's been our intention all along, if we get approved for this loan, to use a chunk of this money toward additional hazard pay. But until we get approved for that, it's irresponsible for me I basically don't have the money to pay enhanced pay. So, and then, of course, they made that letter public, and the Courier Journal called me, and I gave the Courier Journal the exact same statement I gave to the employees, and they wrote about it in the paper, which, I was proud of what I wrote. I didn't have anything to hide. I was willing to be completely transparent. So we had a few people not show up for work at a few stores, and out of solidarity, I signed up to personally work a couple of shifts in stores, mm-hmm. which I had not done for years. So I strapped an apron on I tell you what, it was hardest. I forgot. It was good for me because I was reminded how hard our employees work. But I worked a couple of shifts, and Shortly thereafter, we did get approved for our PPP loan, and I was able to announce that for an 8-week period, everybody that worked got an additional $3 per hour, and anybody that worked 30 hours or more a week got an additional $100 on top of their $3 an hour per week, $3 per hour for that week worked. And we were able to do that for 8 weeks, and then we wound it down slowly, went to $2 an hour extra for several weeks, to $1 an hour extra for several weeks. And that around the end of July, that probably ended. But also during that period of time, Peggy, I started sending, we use an internal communication app called Ready App, which when everybody signs on with us, they sign on to Ready App, and we break them into groups. Store managers can communicate with their store teams via Ready App, and then I can communicate with the entire company via Ready App. So around late March, early April, I started sending a message every day at right after Governor Beshear's afternoon press conference with just an update on anything new that I'd learned. Often the message was, hey, no change in the guidance, you know, this is what we're doing, this is what we're going to continue to do. Look out for each other, check in on each other. We're going to get through this, you know, those types of things. And I did that every day through about the end of May or into early June or so. But that seemed to help everybody take a deep breath. And it didn't make it easy. It's still hard today. But that took us through into the early summer. And anyway, at the risk of rambling, maybe I'll just pause there and see if you want to redirect my
not at all. What you're saying is very good. A lot of people can't do the day-to-day stuff like you're doing, and it's valuable.
Okay. You know, the primary focus of the project is the pandemic. Is that correct, Peggy?
We'll be talking about other things that happened this year. We'll talk about the political aspect. We'll get in there, and then we'll talk about how the three different levels of government, or even internationally, have dealt with it. In your opinion, we'll talk about some of the racial aspects of the pandemic.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll just say that, you know, after a really, I mean, you know, like everybody, it seemed to come out of nowhere and caught, you know, none of us has lived through a pandemic. So it was, felt like we were making it up as we went. And every day it felt like something a little different. You know, we got to a place of, you know, I'll call it stabilization. You know, we did have a few, you know, we've had COVID, we've been experiencing COVID for 10 months now. Yeah. We've had COVID show up in our stores, and we committed early on to, if there was a COVID positive employee, we would close the store. We would have it professionally cleaned, and we would go through the steps we needed to go through to get people tested, to get comfortable that there were enough employees who were healthy that we could reopen the store. Now that definition of what that means and how that has to play out seems to continue to change. You know, 10 months in, we in fact, you know, because we had an employee at one of our stores test positive within the last week and a half or so at a different location, and we've gotten from in the first couple of times that happened, it was you know, high level of anxiety and almost panic. Everybody seems to be able to just roll with that a little bit better now. Okay, this has happened. Here's the drill. When was the last time, the store manager has to get involved. When was the last time people were in contact with this person? Let's figure out the amount of time of incubation they need since they've last seen that person. Let's get them tested. Once we've got enough of people who test negative for COVID, we can reopen the store. So that's happened. And I'll be honest, that's happened less frequently than I was afraid it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have, of our 18 stores, only 15 are open today. There are two stores we have in downtown Louisville that, for a lot of reasons that we can talk about eventually, We closed those back in probably June. They're still not open. And then recently we decided to close one of our two remaining cafe only stores that didn't have a drive through because we just weren't doing enough business to justify being able to keep it open. So anyway, but again, I've been pleasantly surprised is the wrong way to put it. I expected more of our employees to be testing positive for COVID than have actually tested positive for COVID in 10 months.
Yeah.
Well, so here we are today. I do want to backtrack and say back in the middle of the summer in the state of Kentucky, there was a significant period of time where restaurants, like our coffee shops, had to go to no indoor seating.
Yeah.
Then at some point this summer, the governor allowed, we went back to restaurants, of which our coffee shops are considered, could go to 50%. Seating capacity. Maybe it started at 25 and it grew to 50. Maybe it grew more than that. But we decided to sit on the sidelines and watch for a while because our employees didn't want us to open our cafes to seating. Yeah. They were very anxious about it. So we had some internal battles about that from an operations front. You know, can we afford to not open our cafes? Can we afford from an employee standpoint to open our cafes? And we went back and forth and we waited and watched, and we saw that it appeared that many restaurants and other coffee shops, including our local competitors and Starbucks, had begun reopening their cafes to limited seating. So in late September, at least 8 or 10 weeks after we could have first done it, we made the decision to go ahead and open our cafes to 50% seating capacity, which, you know, we, up until that point, we were not even letting people come in and order at the counter. It was only drive-through. So that was really, we saw a nice uptick in sales when we did that. And we kept operating that way until right before Thanksgiving. I think the governor saw the potential danger for people gathering again,
right,
and slammed the door closed again on indoor seating. So we went back to no indoor seating, but we did leave the stores open for people to walk in and do cafe carryout.
Yeah.
Now, sometime within the last, well, even right before Christmas, I think the governor went back to, the state of Kentucky went back to 50% seating capacity. We've decided we're not going to open, our stores still do not, are still not open for indoor cafe seating. And we just feel like we can do enough business through our drive-thrus and with cafe carryout to stay alive, and our employees, I feel like we're doing the right thing for our employees, and we're creating a lot of goodwill with our employees because they're aware that we could be open to a larger extent than we are right now, but we just feel like it's we're doing the right thing. So anyway, here we are 10 months in. I was just looking at the calendar today. It's hard to believe. There was a period of time when I wrung my hands and I wondered, are we going to make it?
Yeah.
About the middle of the summer, I got to a point where I said, you know, the PPP loan had come through, which was really important to us through the CARES Act. The Paycheck Protection Program loan was critical for us. I stopped worrying if we were going to make it about mid late summer, and my believe it or not, by the end of the year, we were back to being operating a cash flow positive and showing a small profit. You know,
wow. What a learning curve. What a learning curve.
Yeah. So we're pretty out, you know, I really believe that I see the light at the end of the tunnel and that we are going to come through this. And we just signed a lease to open a new store. We're going to open out in the Valley Station neighborhood, which is, you know, South Dixie Highway. We signed the lease about 3 weeks ago. We'll open out there later this spring. And we're at the finish line to open a store out in the Fern Creek neighborhood this summer as well. So I feel, from a business standpoint, I'm not even cautiously optimistic anymore. I'm optimistic that we're going to get through this.
Well, that makes me feel good, actually.
Yeah, we're good.
that's wonderful. And you know, the fact is, you know, the vaccines are coming, so we've got some light at the end of the tunnel, I think, you know, for everybody.
This is all assuming that our country doesn't go to war and burn itself down.
Well, that's what we're just getting ready to talk about. Do you think the pandemic has been politicized?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think it's unfortunate, you know, the fact that we're arguing with each other over masks, the fact that somehow we allowed masks that could protect the vulnerable and the elderly in our country, that we allowed that become political is just, it's just so, it's really disappointing and saddening to me. You know, I think most of us who wear masks willingly believe in freedom and believe in personal choice. But at the same time, the fact that we didn't have leadership. I really do feel like there was a failure in leadership in our country, that we didn't have leadership who could rally us around working together to protect those most at risk and most vulnerable. I mean, this is outside of, you know, impact on businesses and closing indoor seating and all that type of thing. The simple fact that wearing a mask became politicized. Yes, I think that it did, and it's disappointing and troubling.
Well, and partly too, the ripping away of science, you know, from the priority, you know, that I'm not saying the business people don't be a part of the picture and the plan, but you cannot take the scientists out. Would you agree?
I agree. And I don't think there was an easy answer, but I think there could have been a lot better leadership toward finding some type of middle ground that maybe wouldn't have satisfied everybody, but that would have been healthier for all of us in the long run. And again, threading that needle as a politician is super tricky. I can't imagine how difficult the Mayor Fisher's job has been, how difficult Governor Beshear's job has been. Again, I don't want to go too deep into my feelings about our current, for at least one more day, president. But I believe that President Trump could have done much more to help unite the country around finding some middle ground rather than playing politics that divided us.
Yeah. And so many people followed him that really were in the know and had power. It's just hard to believe, really.
A little mind-boggling, yeah.
You think, Mike, that it cost him the election? I mean, really, he got a lot of votes. Do you think maybe the handling of the pandemic is what cost him the election?
I would say that it was definitely a factor.
Because there was all that ticket splitting. A lot of people voted for the congressmen that were Republican, but they took him out of the picture, so...
But I think a lot of those Republicans who got elected were allies of Trump's who were saying the same types of things about the pandemic. So I think it was more than just the pandemic that cost him the election, but I think it definitely contributed. His handling definitely contributed.
All right, let's talk a little bit about what you alluded to, and that's how the different levels of government have handled the pandemic. Let's start out with Greg Fisher. How do you think the Fisher administration did in terms of handling the pandemic?
Well, I'll be honest and say that I feel like I'm more aware of how Governor Beshear at the state level handled it, because I feel like that's what, from a business standpoint, I've been paying more attention to.
Well, let's talk about that then.
Yeah. So starting with the governor, I I'm a big fan of Governor Beshear's. I voted for him, and I believe that he has had an unbelievably difficult job of, again, threading that needle between trying to keep us safe, keep all of us safe, but primarily the elderly and the vulnerable, while also realizing that, without an economy, when we're finished with all this, none of us is, it's going to be, the problems are going to be even worse, if we take the wrong actions and our economy literally crashes and burns. I think he did a really wonderful job. I think his commitment to showing up in person, speaking from the heart directly to the people, taking hard questions from the media. I think he did a great job. I think it was a no-win situation in many ways, especially when you consider how political things are and how conservative our state is. I think he continues to do a wonderful job, and I'm grateful that he's our governor, because as we both know, the governor that immediately preceded him is cut from a very similar cloth to President Trump, and I can't imagine how much differently things would have gone in Kentucky, and potentially how much worse things could have gone in Kentucky.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you have to remember that Beshear only won by a very slim margin. So we were lucky in that way.
And in the meantime, now the state legislature is trying to punish him and to take away power, and it's just infuriating to me on so many levels. As a quick aside, I don't know if you saw Morgan McGarvey's.
Yes, I did.
Message. I mean, we are so fortunate to have State Senator Morgan McGarvey representing us in Frankfurt, because he's a big thinker with a big heart who understands, I think, what leadership really means.
And he's hitting his head up against a supermajority. It's not easy.
It's lonely. I traded messages with him last week just to tell him that I had his back in whatever way I could have it, because I know he's in a lonely spot.
Yeah. Well, and I actually think there's just some outright jealousy of some of these people toward Beshear, because Beshear has become such a persona. I mean that in the most positive way.
Yeah.
This reaching out and really showing. I mean, I feel like each death is so personal to him, and that's really come across.
Yeah, I feel like he's tried to be a leader and a uniter, and I think you're right. I think they're jealous. I think they're seeing what we're feeling, that he's proving that he's a leader, and it's scaring them as politicians that he's gonna ride this kind of thing to re-election.
Yeah,
you know, back to your point, your question about Mayor Fisher. You know, I think, you know, if I think about Mayor Fisher in 2020, my thoughts about him really center more on, you know, the protests around racial injustice that we saw in Louisville and around the country and around the world.
And we're going to talk about that in just a minute.
Because so you know, in my limited sort of recall of Mayor Fisher in the pandemic, I think, you know, I know he and his the leader of the health department, I think they've been in, I don't know if lockstep with the governor is right or not. But I think my impression is they have been doing the right thing too, and trying to balance, making sure we protect the elderly and the vulnerable, do smart things like wear masks, stay socially distant, while at the same time trying to be smart, allow businesses to open, but, you know, with no real roadmap to use. I think they did a really, really, they continue to do a really nice job in a really difficult environment.
Well, the Secretary of State the Attorney General and some of the people in Frankfurt, they said, well, we agree with what you're doing, but we're going to sue you anyway, just to kind of test it. I mean, just from a point of view of, don't use our tax dollars on stuff like that.
I know. It makes your head want to explode. I mean,
it really does. It really does. All right. What about, you know, I failed to ask you about your kids and everything. How are they doing in terms of your college students and that sort of thing?
Well, you know, they're doing pretty well. I only had my oldest in college last spring when the pandemic hit. So at spring break, they sent them home. So she came home and finished the year from here. And that was difficult, but it was just her sophomore year in college. So wasn't that difficult. My three other kids who were 18, 16, and 14 at the time, they're 18, 17, and 15 now. They, you know, they're lucky. They're smart kids. You know, school comes relatively easy for them. We've got good fast wireless here. They all have their own notebook computers, so they were able to handle NTI it was unpleasant. They saw their sports seasons, those that were playing sports, get canceled. They saw my son, who was a senior in high school, was not able to do things like senior prom. Graduation happened, but it was a drive-by graduation. So there were a lot of the most of it, and nobody got too down and out about it. And the reality is, my wife and I've said this many times, we got an unbelievable amount of time with our six-person family for a long period of time there, where we shared meals and we laughed and we had time together that we would never have had otherwise. And it was one of the true silver linings to a pandemic, if there can be a silver lining to a pandemic, the amount of family time we got. Now that started to wear a little bit thin, I guess.
Sure.
The summer, people started missing their friends and we missed our friends and nobody was traveling, but the two older kids did go back to college this fall. They're doing it remotely, even on campus, but they got to be living in situations where my daughter was in an apartment off campus and my son was in a solo dorm. The schools that they go to, the University of South Carolina and the Savannah College of Art and Design, are both doing really nice jobs of making sure the kids stay safe. The NTI, you know, virtual instruction, it's not the same, but I'm really proud of them. They're making the most of it. My high schoolers are, they continue to do okay, but they're tired of it. You know, they miss their friends and they miss, you know, they miss being at school and the virtual learning. Again, we're lucky. My wife and I are involved. They're not going to fall dramatically behind, but it's wearing thin, and we're all hoping they're going to be back in school maybe in March or April.
Well, I'm hoping that too, since I'm doing NTI 5 days a week for grandkids.
Yeah, you got to be exhausted. Yeah, it's hard work.
Well, I keep saying, oh, I'm going to be closer to them than I ever would have. And that's true.
You're right.
But sometimes at 5 o'clock.
You're exhausted, yeah.
Your grandkids,
your grandkids are lucky to have you, because we both know there are a lot of kids out there in the Louisville and the rest of the country that don't have grandkids or grandparents or parents who are able to help them through the process. And it's heartbreaking to think that kids, especially the kids who least deserve it, are going to be falling a little bit further behind. And we've got to figure out as a society what we're going to do about that to help them.
Bigger, you know, divide between the haves and have nots. Yeah. That's certainly very obvious. My son-in-law teaches at Newcomer Academy up in Indianapolis, where it's, you know, all immigrants, a lot of poverty, and I mean, the parents have to be working so the kids are home by themselves. It's just, you know, it's just stunning, really. Well, you know, you anticipated one of my questions. Has anything good come to you as a result of the pandemic?
Yeah, I think the time with the family has been good. We have in the last 6 months of we've done some outdoor gatherings, small gatherings with friends, you know, on the back porch or around the fire pit, you know, even this winter, even last week, January, the temps outside are in the 40s. We had a couple of people over and built a fire and sat outside. And I think my appreciation of time with friends has deepened. And so time with family, time with friends, those are the things that I've enjoyed the most. So a few silver linings there.
Some other people have talked about just more tools in your toolkit. You know, when you find out about Zoom and you can do this, that, and the other, some of the things that you learn from having to get through this that might be carried over into, you know, post-pandemic.
I do think you're right. I think we're going to spend a lot less time in the car driving to meetings. I think there's going to be a lot of, you know, one-on-ones or even, you know, group meetings where we don't need to all get in the car for 20 minutes and drive across town. We've gotten comfortable doing it via Zoom. You can accomplish a lot in one of these meetings. Never going to replace face-to-face time, but it is nice. And I think I've been reading that telehealth has come into the 21st century like it needed to, which is going to benefit a lot of people who don't have easy access to getting to the doctor's office, et cetera.
And my daughter, the one I'm doing NTI for, she's in her basement office doing, 8 hours of therapy every day.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh.
Believe me, that's really an unnecessary occupation
People have needed it for sure.
Yeah. Let's see. Let's talk about the racial situation.
Yeah.
I know that you don't think that there was a causation in terms of the George Floyd thing or the Breonna Taylor or David McAtee here locally, in terms of the pandemic didn't cause it. But did the stress and the just desperation of the pandemic, do you think that really played a role in how much racial unrest we've had?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that it played a role. I think people's, everybody's anxiety level was high. you know, people were, there was a lot of fear, sadness, loneliness happening. And, you know, we all saw the video of George Floyd being killed. And I think, and everybody had so much time on their hands to be online.
Yes.
That, you know, the conditions were perfect for people to explode, or they were not perfect. They were ripe for people to explode. And then to find out, I think we had already heard about Ahmaud Arbery and how troubling that was.
Yeah.
And then we hear about George Floyd, and then right on the heels of George Floyd, all of a sudden here in Louisville, we hear about Breonna Taylor, and it had happened back in March, and none of us knew about it. I think people were ready for sure to take action, and you know, and I like to think that even if there wasn't a pandemic going on, that something would have happened, some type of, you know, we've needed significant action in this country for a long time. So but I think the pandemic was a contributing factor for sure.
Well, especially when you think about people's desperate situation. Some people are being evicted.
I mean,
it's horrible. I mean, I was talking to somebody about JCC downtown, JCTC, where I used to teach. And they said, you're just stepping over the homeless to go in the doors in the morning.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, it's horrible. You know, you feel so badly for people.
Yeah.
And yet you can't expect the restaurants downtown to let... It's so horrible, you know, because now the bathrooms and everything are closed up where people can't even clean up like they used to. This is just pretty dehumanizing, really.
It is. It's amazing that in a country as wealthy as we are, we don't have better systems and services in place to, I mean, we're not going to be able to necessarily fix everything, but it sure seems like we could be doing more than we're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when you think about more people of color are actually dying from the pandemic. Just all kinds of reasons why people are stirred up, even with their distrust of the medical system because of all the history of how people have been misused and experiments and that sort of thing. What about the environment? What have you heard in terms of the environment and the pandemic's impact?
You mean on the natural environment?
Well, yes, the natural environment.
You know, I'm not really sure I'm understanding your question. You know, I think something like climate change is still as big an issue as it ever was. I think that, you know, one way that it's shown up for me, this is micro and I may be going off in the wrong direction, but, you know, one of the reasons that as I understand it, that, you know, so many of our Black neighbors are being impacted as heavily as they are by COVID is related to bad air, which is related to a planet that's getting too hot.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a loose thread that ties the environment to COVID. But what are you getting at, Peggy?
Well, actually, in some ways, the environment has been affected for the better by the COVID pandemic people are not going to work.
Wasn't it great to see some of those pictures of LA or other cities where the smog had cleared up? Yeah. My hope is that, well, you know, early on in COVID, early COVID, you know, those first couple months, I remember when I would see people, one of my questions for them is, what can we be learning about what we're doing right now that are going to impact how we act when COVID's over? You know, are we going to roar back to doing everything exactly the way we've always done it? And some people looked at me like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, do we have to be as wound up as we are about some of the small things that we're wound up about? And, you know, do we have to continue to get in our cars and go everywhere and jump on airplanes and go
exactly
everywhere? You know, I, on a more, you know, on a broader level for me, that question really also centered around, you know, what's important, you know, what are we going to prioritize in our personal lives?
So many people have responded that way. Yeah.
And again, I still continue to think about some of those things, but I don't know that I feel like just in the last month or two here, in fact, I was talking with my operations director at work today. I said, I feel like we're finally getting to a place where we're not playing defense. This, you know, I hate to make it all about work, but boy, keeping the small coffee company afloat, it's been hard. And I feel like it's been a lot of reaction and a lot of defense and not as much planning, thinking about the future. And I feel like on many levels, we're coming out of that. And I include that for me personally. I feel like my head is clearing up a little bit and I'm beginning to think about the future again. So I want to revisit that question that I was asking people back in the early pandemic, you know, as we're approaching what looks like maybe coming out the other side of this, what do I want my life to look like? You know,
yeah.
And what am I going to do about making sure that my priorities, what I say are my priorities, really show up as priorities? So it's going to be interesting to see if I can do that.
Well, on the climate thing too, or in the environment thing, it really is, I think, a reminder or an answer to some people who are climate change doubters that humans really do have an impact. You know,
sure.
This is pretty well something you can almost measure right now. You know, as we backed off our cars, as we backed off the use of airplanes, that we are seeing a change. So
yeah,
for all those people,
sure.
Oh, no, you know, it's kind of a proof, really.
For sure.
Yeah. All right. 50 to 100 years from now, when historians and other analysts look at this period and try to assess it, maybe write history books, what do you think their analysis will be?
Well, I think they're going to be, I think there's going to be a lot of analysis around the politicization of the pandemic and the anti-maskers and the people that didn't, you know, that couldn't see the value in short-term sacrifice from a business and consumer standpoint to try to protect people. So I think they're going to look at where, you know, this didn't just all happen because of the pandemic. You know, something has been happening in our society for a long time now that's been causing us to separate. And we, you know, it wasn't just Trump that brought that to our country. You know, there's the forces of globalization and, you know, so many things have contributed to certain parts of our country. Somehow they've gotten to this place where there's this lack of hope. They don't see opportunity anymore for themselves or their children. And then if you get, you know, you get the wrong type of leader involved, and they drive, they work to drive that wedge. And so we're really, I feel a real hunger personally for someone to help bring us back together, to help us find some common ground, to help.
Well, you also want to think that your children are going to do better than you did.
People who are so afraid and feel so hopeless. Sure. Yeah. I really spent a lot of time trying to think about what could have somebody become an anti-masker, or what could have somebody want to vote for somebody like Donald Trump to be president of the United States? And what can we do? What should I be doing to help reach out to them and help them feel like there is a person saying just that, you know, we need to think about how we can reach out to these people we disagree with, because without, you know, we've got to figure out how to find some common ground and connect again.
Well, I think even opening I think even opening a coffee shop in Valley Station. Coffee shop in Valley Station is a movement in that direction, frankly.
Well, I like to think so. I do. But I think again, in 50 or 100 years, when people are looking back on this time, and they're going to talk of, hopefully, they're going to see that I mean, the fact that we were able to develop a vaccine in the short amount of time that we've been able to do, I think, what a miracle of science. And I think we're going to look at that and wow, what an example of unbelievable cooperation and great use of resources. So that, I think that kind of thing will be celebrated. But then you look at the politicization of the vaccine. And they're going to shake their heads and go, what was wrong with those people? And how could they have been so polarized as a society?
Well, they're even talking about vaccine diplomacy now. And of course, the Chinese are going into countries that we were in helping at one point in time, and they're vaccinating. And so it is vaccine diplomacy in politics.
Yep, for sure. Yeah. But back to that statement you just made, you know, I like to think that the coffee shop can be a place where people can maybe connect again. You know, I've been saying this for years, you know, when we hire new people at our coffee shop company, we bring them in groups of 4 to 15, depending on how many we need at a time. In fact, I've got one this Wednesday. We call them new employee orientations. We're doing them virtually right now, but I lead the first hour to 90 minutes of each one of those, welcoming people to our company. And I tell them about who they're working for, who we're trying to be as a company, because I want people to like where they, my goal is I want them to like where they work, because I feel like if they like where they work, they're going to care more about our customers and that type of thing. And among many things I emphasize is that I want everybody to feel welcome in our shops, and I want us to be committed to treating everyone with respect and dignity. I said that earlier, and I mean that. And we start with each other, and then we flow out to our customers. And I said, it's going to be tricky, you know, because most of the people that know me and know our company know that we lean a little bit left from a social justice political standpoint. But I want people that don't think like I do to feel welcome coming in our shop. So the people that are attracted to work with, or a lot of the people that are attracted to work with us, are drawn to us because of our social justice track record. So we've got a lot of big-hearted people. And they're the kind of people who, like me, if they see someone wearing a Make America Great hat again, it can make them a little uncomfortable. But I tell people very specifically, if somebody comes in wearing a MAGA hat, or if Mitch McConnell walks into our store at the Douglas Loop, you know, I want us to smile at them. I want us to ask them how they're doing. I want to serve them a great cup of coffee. And as long as they can treat you with respect and dignity and treat our fellow customers with respect and dignity, we want them sitting in our coffee shops.
Absolutely. And
maybe, just maybe, somebody who doesn't think like they do will engage with them and they can have a conversation. I said, because if we continue to silo ourselves into internet echo chambers, we're doomed.
You know, the church I go to, your mom's church, St. William's, we have a sister parish in Escapulas, Nicaragua, which is a wonderful thing. But about 6 months, I suggested, how about a sister parish in Mount Washington?
Yeah.
And they go, what? There were no takers on that idea.
Wow.
And I'm still trying to whittle away at people and say, you know what? We got to reach across that divide.
You're smart. I agree completely. You know, we need more opportunities to talk and find the areas where we agree. You know, we all love our children. We all love our schools, our churches. You know, most of us love the environment. How can we work together?
Even in cooperating or cleaning up the side of the highway together.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pick something that you both can agree on. And there is stuff that you can't agree on.
Yeah, but isn't that interesting that St. William, that's filled with, you know, super smart, super big-hearted, committed people who walk the talk of doing good work. And you'd really rather not sit in a room with those people who may have voted for Donald Trump, you know?
I'm still working on it.
All right. Don't give up. Don't give up.
Well, let me ask you, one of the things that people have really talked about, especially like me and your mom, people who live alone, that it's just been so egregious to have to live without physical touch, where you can't hug your grandchildren, you can't kiss people in your family, you can't handshake. I mean, that's been really difficult to handle. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's been, it's been hard, and it's been particularly hard, I think, for my family with our moms. You know, my wife's mom lives three blocks away. She's 82. You know, my mom lives 10 minutes away. She's 82. And, you know, we've tried to stay in touch, but we've tried to also be very intentionally keep them at arm's length, or even, you know, five or six arm's lengths,
yes.
You know, because at 82, you just don't want to get COVID. I mean, I'm 57. I don't want to get COVID, but at 82, you don't want to get it. And, it's been a little weird. And that, like, Thanksgiving and Christmas, you know, were strange because we didn't do the big family get togethers.
Yeah.
And I miss it with my family, and I miss it with my closest friends too. You know, we're a pretty affectionate group of, we're fortunate. We've got a pretty affectionate group of friends. So we were regularly together and greeted and parted with a big, you know, long hug. And I miss that. I really feel the absence for sure. And I think my kids feel it. And I know my mom feels it. And I know my wife's mom feels it.
Well, my last question is, when we get past this acute phase, maybe when we are all have gotten the vaccine and we've got herd immunity, what do you think the new normal will be like?
I think that's a good question. And I have been talking with people about that lately. In fact, we were saying recently, or today, I was talking with my operations director about, you know, how long are we all going to be wearing masks? And, you know, I think we may be wearing masks, you know, through the summer and into the fall. And the kids may be wearing masks at school when they're in the classrooms next fall. But I can't imagine that we're not going to, assuming the vaccine rolls out like it looks like it's going to, you know, sometime this summer or this fall, we hit this, you know, 75 to 80% level of herd immunity. I can't imagine that by this time next year or as we get into 2022, we haven't put the masks away. And, you know, I think I can't imagine not being back at the Kentucky Center for the Arts, sitting shoulder to shoulder, you know, watching the Louisville Orchestra. I mean, on some levels, it'll break my heart if we're not, you know. I mean, we got through the Spanish flu pandemic back in the early part of the 20th century. I don't know my history well enough to know how long it took people to feel comfortable gathering together, but I feel like we're going to, the vaccine's going to roll out. The trust is going to be there. The infection rate is going to go down to something manageable. The death rate is going to drop to levels that don't show up on our daily radar screen. And we are going to be shoulder to shoulder again at musical events and sporting events and sitting around the table with friends and even strangers again.
Yeah. Well, that's all my questions. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add? It's been a wonderful session.
Yeah, you know, Peggy, if it's okay, I'm going to add just one thing that's pandemic related, and just for the archive, just in case somebody stumbles across this. You know, in our coffee shop, we went through a really challenging stretch in early June that was related to the protests around George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery. David McAtee hadn't even been killed yet, I don't think. But anyway, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, you know, the conditions were really ripe for people to erupt, you know, over this. And so, you know, during my communication with our employees in late May, you know, I acknowledged that, hey, I'm aware, you know, I just want to acknowledge how tragic what we're learning about George Floyd is, about Breonna Taylor, you know. It's just hard to imagine. I said, I just want everybody to trust that, you know, we're going to find the right way as a company to be part of real and lasting change in this community related to racial justice, you know, just like we've been trying to do for 25 years. And I got some real immediate reaction from people that wasn't enough, you know, why other companies were beginning to make public statements via social media about how they stood with, you know, the families of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, and they, you know, stood with Black Lives Matter. And people were asking me, when are we going to make a statement? And I said, until I've got my I was just looking at this again today because I'm speaking to an MBA class at U of L next week. A really brilliant man named Nat Irvin teaches in the MBA school at U of L. So he invited me to speak about leadership in crisis. So I was thinking back through it today, and I my response was, look, I get it, you know, because they were feeling they wanted to be proud of where I can see it all more clearly today than I could in the heat of things. Yeah. They wanted to be proud of where they worked. They wanted to be able to tell people, my employer is standing up for Black Lives Matter and for racial justice. And again, I felt like our company track record spoke pretty loudly for itself, and that I felt like a vacuous statement was risked being just a vacuous statement. And you may have seen that a lot of companies threw up things like this on the internet, and they were immediately attacked, like, what a bunch of hogwash, you know, where have you been for the last, you know, 50 years? So, and then right around this time, we got a complaint that one of our employees, one of our stores, had put up a handwritten sign on the drive-thru speaker box that said "Justice for Brianna." Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got 18 stores at the time. You know, we've got a policy. We can't have handwritten signs going up all over the store. You know, it could quickly get out of hand.
Yeah.
So it was sort of on the fly. This was a pretty stressful time.
Yeah.
Pandemic, racial unrest. So several of my leadership were around, and we were like, the manager knows better. The store manager should never have let that go up.
Yeah.
Take it down. And in the meantime, I'm going to wrap this up so I don't go on forever. And around the same period of time, one of my managers at a different store, he had emailed me, and he said, "Hey, Mike, I want to put up a Black Lives Matter sign in our store. Just checking with you, you know, going through things the right way." Right. And I said, "Gosh," I said, "Adrian, it's with a little bit of a heavy heart that I'm going to say no." I said, "But here's what I want you to do. I want you to work with me to help me find," Adrian is, he wouldn't mind me telling you this, he is a transgendered individual, and he's been very involved in the transgender community and leading sensitivity trainings through Queer Kentucky. And I even, with two of my people on my leadership team, went through one of his trainings on transgender sensitivity training. I said, "You're a leader, you know," I said, "I want you to help me find a leader in the racial justice space to take our leadership through a training to help us understand what can we do as a company to best make an impact. I'm less interested in making statements that are going to potentially piss off a bunch of my customers. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in thoughtful action or thoughtful work around what we can do that's going to make a difference long term." Because I said these, and I said this a couple times to groups of employees, we're going to be here doing this work long after a lot of people who are all jazzed up about this move on to something else. So anyway, things quickly escalated, and my employees got very upset with me that I made that sign for Justice for Brianna come down. We also, in the meantime, there were a couple of other handwritten Black Lives Matter signs up. I said, "You got to take them down. I mean, we can't just let employees be deciding what the company's for." And that was for several reasons. And, you know, I'll be really honest, one of which was we don't have a lot of margin for error in the coffee shop world. And I need everybody coming to our coffee shop. I don't want bigots or out and out racists coming into the coffee shop. But I can't afford to tick off a significant percentage of our customer base. So anyway, things escalated. It got really, really, heated quickly over like a 3 or 4 day period. And I finally said, "You know what? I think what the employees want me to do is just make a public statement around support for Black Lives Matter." So we made a public statement on social media about how just upset we were by the tragic deaths of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and maybe David McAtee had died at the time. We stand with Black Lives Matter, and we're gonna work hard to figure out how to do our part to make sure that there is lasting and real change in this community. Well, led by a couple of my most angry employees, the internet went a little bananas, a certain percentage, and it was I can't even tell you how intense it was. It was, it's still up on our social media stuff. If anybody ever wants, I'm not going to take it down because I want people to be able to see that it's there. Sure. The comments were, as about as hateful as you could possibly imagine and worse. You know, it's only with some distance that I can actually talk about it without getting highly emotional. But we, so anyway, it was horrible. And the next morning I got up, and later, while it was all going on, I sent a message to all my employees and I said, you know what? I'm getting this message loud and clear. I've changed our company position. If you want to put up signs in your stores, you can put them up. I said, I realize there are some that are going to say, I'm just bowing to pressure, but you know, I'm counting on people to trust me that, you know, we've been working hard for 25 plus years and we're not going to stop working hard for racial justice. And I got to just keep moving forward at this point. I wrote a public apology that went up on the internet that was unmercilessly attacked. Again, it was unbelievable. Although, and then the next day, it was about 5 days of unbelievable craziness. But you know what? I just, with the support of my wife and my kids and a lot of others, I just kept getting up, you know, again, try to get up each day and learn and do a little bit better, right? In hindsight, it was some clunky decision-making that I think, knowing what I know now, it could have gone a little easier, a little better.
Sure.
But I'm still not ashamed of anything that we did. In fact, and out of that, several good things have come, and I'm just going to tell you a couple of them, and then I am going to stop. I had several people reach out to me in the heat of things, one of which was Nat Irvin, who is a Black man who teaches at the University of Louisville, and he wanted me to know right away that he knew who I was and that he wanted me to know that he was there for me. He did want me to hear from me what happened. He joked with me. He said, Mike, how the hell did you let this happen? You know, meaning the internet firestorm. And we've stayed in touch fairly regularly. And he just about a month ago invited me to speak to his MBA class. So I'm doing that next week. I had the most interesting young man who happens to be Black. He's probably in his 30s, who lives in St. Matthews. He reached out to me and he said, hey, Mike, I'm a longtime customer of your St. Matthews store. I saw everything that went on down on the internet. I was going through your drive-thru this morning and I saw that you now do have a Black Lives Matter sign up in your store. Glad to see it. He said, are you interested in meeting for coffee? So I met him for coffee in June and we have now met every month since the month of June. And we've developed the friendship and we're going to continue it. You know, in fact, I just traded text with him today. His wife's due with their first baby on inauguration day. So I was just checking in on him. I could give another, I've got another friend named Nardi White who, he lives down at 27th and Lytle. He's a Black man who grew up in the Portland neighborhood. He founded the River City Drum Corps, which is a youth African drum corps. I met Nardi years ago because we hired the River City Drum Corps to play at some events we had at Heine Brothers. And he reached out to me to check on me to make sure I was okay. And I started going to his house about every 3 weeks up until COVID got really crazy this fall. We took a pause, but we're committed to continuing to deepen our relationship in an effort to try to help me understand the his world and vice versa to figure out how we can maybe improve things. So one of the silver linings to what we went through is that I'm now in communication with significantly more Black people than I have ever been in my life. I had friends, but I wasn't in regular communication with very many Black people. In fact, that's one thing that Nat Irvin said to me when he called me in June. He's like, Mike, you need to spend more time with Black people. I said, no kidding, Nat. Help me connect with some more Black
people. Help me out on that.
Yeah, so anyway, and then the last thing I'll tell you is I mentioned that Adrian, our manager, who I had asked to help me find somebody to help our company learn a little bit. With Adrian's help, I was able to connect with a brilliant woman at JCTC named Danielle Sims Brooks. And Danielle's an assistant VP, and she is a Black woman. And she agreed to work with us And we took 25 people, my HQ leadership team, all the way down through our store managers, through 4 6-hour sessions this summer. It was really about, It was learning, you know, what is racism? How does racism show up? What are our blind spots? You know, where are our company's blind spots? And all of us are white that we're going through it in mm-hmm. the company. We've got some black baristas, but we don't have any black people in leadership. And it was a really healthy exercise with a lot of participation, not just physically, but verbally from leadership at Heine Brothers. It was really good. It was a healing exercise for us to do that together as a company. And that ended in late August. And since in September, a 5-person group of our operations leadership has continued. I've contracted with Danielle to work with her for the rest of the year to help us now take action on some of the things that we've learned. So we're in the process of, simple things, trying to find more black people to work as baristas in our company, trying to develop a pipeline for black baristas to pretend who are interested to become store managers.
Yeah.
And then number three, develop an internship program for students that targets black students to be interns. So
that's fantastic. We're winding up. I am glad that.
So I was just going to say.
What?
Yeah, I was just going to say. So it was. I didn't want to leave this interview without mentioning that episode, that period, because it was super intense and super challenging as a leader, and I never in a million years thought it. That could have happened. And I went through a period there where I didn't feel like I had my footing. I felt like the earth had really shifted beneath my feet. And anyway, part of the reason that it happened as intensely as it did is because I've been able to attract a really passionate group of employees that work with me, and they feel things deeply, and they felt what was going on in our world and in our city very deeply. And they really challenged me to, and we've come through it. We're not finished yet. We've got a lot of work to do as a company, but we're moving forward, and we're going to be part of making our community a more just, a racially just community.
Well, this has been a wonderful interview, and I really do appreciate this last bit, because this is one of the best pieces of self-analysis that I've interviewed. And I think that when you're really studying 20 years from now what went on, what business went through, especially with regard to this racial aspect, this contribution will really be something they can sink their teeth into. Well, thanks. I really appreciate it.
I hope so. You know, it's been a learning experience for me for sure. And I hope somebody benefits from it down the road.
Yes, thank you so much. One more thing quickly is that if you know anybody else that you think would be a good interview, can you connect me, please?
Sure. Yeah, I sure will. Are you looking for all shapes, sizes, and colors? Or
yes, all shapes, sizes. I have nobody that's even close to food service. You're my first person. And okay. And one of the problems is that it's not that I don't know it, but it's like the people I know, some of them have been laid off, and they're not at peace with that. Getting laid off, even though it's not your fault, is still something that people bear that horrible shame for. And so anyway, I'm not trying to pick at anybody's scabs or anything, and I don't push people to be interviewed. But if you have anybody in the industry, anybody that you think
I will
just connect me.
I'll send them your way, Peggy.
Okay. Thank you so much. All right. Really appreciate your time.
I enjoyed the chat. Good talking to you, and I hope I get to see you in person sometime in 2021.
I know your mom.
All right. Thanks,
Peggy. Bye.